I'm Alex from Shopify Money, and I'm panicked about my second child upstairs.
My man from Norway, K Nutt.
Hey, my man from Canada. How are you?
We've got a triple continent, a triple Lindsay. We've got Canada on the phone. We've got Norway in the house, and I'm a citizen of the world now. You know what I mean? I'm traveling. I'm living my best podcast life.
That's awesome.
Today's special guest, friend, he's the only guy who goes by, he's like a Madonna. He didn't even give out his full name in the intro. It's just Alex now with three X's. Triple X, triple threat, Alex Danko. He's panicked about his second child. And I'm like, nothing makes me happier because I love my kids and now they're almost, they're just on the payroll and they're just good kids. Nothing makes me happier to know the hell that these people are facing for the next 20 years. The ups, the downs, the I hate yous, the poops, the peas. Alex mentioned he's a little panicked about baby number two upstairs. And that just made my day a little brighter to know that my day is going to be better most of the time for the next 20 years than his. So Alex Danko is one of my favorite reads, one of my favorite brains, one of my favorite thinkers. He's become a podcaster, but I don't care because I don't listen to other podcasts. And I don't care if I ask the same questions that he just answered yesterday while he was whoring himself on somebody else's podcast. But he works for one of my favorite companies in the world, maybe other than Netflix. At the moment, my favorite, Shopify. I have a lot of questions about him. The stock has gone sideways for 3 months. I hold him responsible, even though he has no say over this. And we're not going to ask him about the stock, but I will still give him shit. So don't let him in on that.
No. Don't worry.
And he's in Toronto, my old hometown. And I feel pretty good about that because they got fucked by COVID. They were just locked in their houses watching bad hockey and bad baseball. Maple Leafs, Raptors, everything. The Jays gave it a run. It was a little bit exciting and couldn't make a playoff this year. So we're going to talk about Shopify. We're going to talk about some funny stuff that we do on the web. He has a really depth of experience because it's social capital. He reads endlessly. He's thinking about fintech and money, obviously understands e-commerce, and has a really big passion around biotech. I bought one of his stock ideas today, Twist Bioscience. So I want to talk about that. And then we want to talk about recruiting. We had a couple funny things. So anyways, do we have time left? Because we had a lot to talk about. And I feel like maybe we'll just do a next episode where we actually ask him questions.
I think this is probably it. Yeah.
And what are you doing, Canute? Anything?
No, not much.
We're building a new studio.
Yes, we are.
How's it coming?
Well, it hasn't really started yet because we haven't gotten the lease done yet. But so we're going to be week? There soon.
Do you know why we can do these things? Where are our kids?
Exactly. They're gone.
They're gone. We can do podcast studios and never even use it because we have so much time on our hands. So let's dial them up.
Sounds good.
Alex Danko.
Hey, everybody. It's good to be back.
It is good to be back. So, Alex, is COVID in your mind as someone who is pretty much locked down? Toronto was, you know, a pleasant socialism for most of it. Where is your head around COVID in Toronto and Canada?
This is a great opener. I'll give you some thoughts on this. So as listeners probably know, Howard actually is Canadian. He has spent his life running away, running into the desert, running all over the world. But he can't escape the fact that he comes from the heart of, you know, straight white bread, Protestant values, Jew, no fun city Jew. Called
you
Toronto,
want to say Judah.
Which is now in this interesting transition right now. The city of Toronto, which yes. is where I call home. I've lived in Toronto for 4 years, lived in Montreal before that, and grew up in Vermont before that. But I'll tell you about Toronto, and I'm going to tell you what happened with COVID and what's happening as we tentatively exit COVID with our great city. So for years and years and years, you know, Toronto was just the most boring place on earth. It was the butt of every joke. It was the city that stood in contrast to Montreal in every way. Montreal was where you went to be cosmopolitan and have a good time and get laid and have, you know, a nice life. Toronto is where you went to go to work and go to bed at 9 p.m. That started to change with the Quiet Revolution in the 1970s when all the Anglos got kicked out of Quebec and went down Highway 401 and set up their lives in Toronto. And we're still boring for a while, but that got stuff going. And then as the city grew and grew and grew, and all of a sudden found itself with this, not only an explosion of people, but an explosion of culture, you know, on its hands. You started to see Drake and The Weeknd and all of this explosion of music and the Raptors and everything happened. And Toronto was starting to step out into the world as a city where things happened. And then COVID happened. Shut that right down.
It did. I mean, Toronto people think that Toronto's is the greatest city ever. And I loved Toronto as a city growing up. Loved it. Would take the subway to the Blue Jay games. Would take the, you know, I'm 10 years old. I could take the subway to the hockey game without getting accosted. Maybe you're supposed to get accosted and that makes you grow up. But it was just one of those sleepy cities. And you had the streetcars and you had somewhat safety of the big city. And that is not the Toronto I remember. I liked the sleepy Toronto. Maybe it did change. But I feel like during COVID, it was exposed. Great hospitals at the high level, but not enough hospitals. Pretty poor leadership. But here we are. I mean, the world is now opening. Where do you see it?
So this is interesting. I'll tell you a couple of things I've noticed. So if you go downtown nowadays, head to downtown Toronto, you'll see something pretty interesting compared to before, which is it feels more like New York City than it did pre-pandemic in a couple interesting ways, which is there are a lot more people riding around on scooters, blaring music out of boomboxes, out of Bluetooth speakers, generally not at all seeing you when you're walking across the street. There's a lot more of a, like, I don't want to call it lawlessness because that's not really the right vibe I'm going for. But there's a lot more, like, as the world opens up, people are now comfortable taking up more space. People have got an interesting kind of new swagger and attitude about them of like, you can't tell me what to do. That is probably half defiance against lockdown and probably half this sort of new equilibria we've managed where as downtown slowly comes back to life, the people who are there, all the food delivery drivers, people who are hanging around downtown up to no good, people who are sort of generally down there have really sort of claimed a lot of the space to themselves and are expressing that character. And I love it. I love it. I am having such a good time every time I go downtown for some reason nowadays. The city feels alive in a way that was very different from what it was before. We're going to find out what happens as, you know, like reopening continues. Because again, like as Howard mentioned, we were locked down for longer than I think any other city anywhere. And it had some useful purpose in the sense that like COVID, you know, deaths and figures and things were far less bad here than they were in the US, for example. And now things are starting to open up and hopefully they'll stay that way. But it's going to be interesting to see whether this is actually like a really interesting step function in people's sort of independence and sense of like, I'm taking up my space. What are you going to do about it as we go forward?
That's a big change for Toronto. Okay. I like it. So I'm excited for Toronto. I'm excited for my friends to be traveling. We can meet up because their kids are also out of the house. You mentioned, you know, you panicked about child number two. Is it just the unknown? Is it the extra work? You know, the screaming and the spitting and the pooping. What panics you?
So okay, what panics me? I'll tell you something that I've learned through going through kid one and now kid two. Kid one is 2 years old. Kid two is 3 months old. I have a lot of friends now who are in the middle of becoming parents. You know, I'm 32. This is when a bunch of my peers are starting to begin their journey as parents. And I always tell them something when they ask, like, what do I need to know about what I'm getting into? My answer to them is like, I don't really have anything useful to tell you except for one thing I can tell you, which is useful, which is why kids are so tiring. And that is that kids demand that you be very, very present, right? When you're playing with your kid or when you're dealing with your kid, whether your kid is happy, whether your kid is sad, it doesn't matter. The one constant is you have to be fully present. You can't be distracted. Can't really be on your phone. You can't be checked out thinking about something else. Your mind can't be wandering somewhere else. You have to be really present. And that is a muscle that we don't have anymore.
Yeah.
We have so many distractions all the time. We're on our phones. We're in our apps. Our mind is just sort of elsewhere thinking about work or whatever. And The thing is like all of us adults are so like that all the time that we kind of get used to that being normal. Conversation with somebody, you know, it's okay that they're 30% thinking about something else. Like this is something that we put up with, but not kids. Kids demand that you be there. And that's tiring, but it's also such a blessing, right? To find that muscle again and learn how to be completely present, you know, whether your kid's having fun or is sad or is crying or is sleeping or whatever it is. You know, it's a muscle you have to get back. And the nice thing about kid two is you've had kid one to practice, right? You're not going to the gym cold.
Yeah.
Right? You've started building those presence muscles.
You're gonna get into it where the difference is now is that muscle, every parent's had to deal with it. The muscle that you had to get used to, for me, it was BlackBerry, then iPhone. Now you're going to have to get used to the fact that once a kid is eight, they're not present. So I think the biggest change coming for parents is, you know, cats in the cradle, where, you know, when my son turned a certain age, it was just all phone all the time. And I'm like, hey, man, I'm willing to be present. They're not going to be willing to be present. So that'll be interesting for you. And again, thrilled that you have to go through it, not me. I'll be writing checks into seed companies making billions of dollars, and you'll be thinking of baby toys and other things.
Yeah. I'll see you once I get over to the other side of the hump in however many years that is.
So let's get right into it with what's got you excited today. I read one thing we laughed about is recruiting, and obviously Shopify is recruiting like crazy. We talked about it in our first podcast, you know. What I'm reading from recruiters is hysterical. Like, you know, I've told my nephews, you know, just put in the time at a great company. You don't have to worry about salary in your first go around. Work, get trained, get yourself into the algorithm of LinkedIn. You will get recruited. Now my nephews are sending me some of the funniest recruiting letters because they've played the game. And I'm reading these recruiting letters, and I shared one, and I said, like, this is like the penny stock board. It's like, there's no rules. So what do you see about that? And is there anything going wrong there or right?
Boy, okay, so this is such a great topic. I'm really glad you kicked us off with this. I would say that there are these two, at least in my world anyway, in the tech world, in the software startup and big co world, you have these two parallel and partially overlapping recruiting scenes, which are, one is startups trying to convince you to work for them, and then the other is these big tech giants trying to convince you to work for them. And where Shopify now is a big grown-up company, has to go, you know, like hire a lot of people and hire it in a competitive market with Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon. And you know, like I personally am like, I've been at Shopify now for a year and a half. Best decision I've made professionally in a long, long, long time. You should come work with me. We are always hiring. Send me a note. But what's tricky about hiring, right, is that exactly like you said, like it used to be that you spent these first X years of your career basically being paid to learn. You were making a down. You weren't like the company that hired you out of college was making an investment into you. And then you have the second phase of your career where you're paid for doing. And then you had this third phase of your career where you're paid for knowing people. And now this career progression would map according to how much leverage you had and how much leverage you could bring the company. Now I'd say something has really changed in the job market, which is that there is this changing understanding about what leverage is. It used to mean executive direction and ability to lead large groups of people and ability to know people and recruit. Now it means software engineering. Now it means software engineers are the leverage. Get them. Get them and get them working effectively. And that is the job.
Got it.
And it really just goes to show how much software is eating the world, right? How software engineers are now the capital, right? I know that like the Collison brothers at Stripe have this really interesting point of view about software engineers as the new units of capital. And about thinking about, you know, like running a business, it's like, what is your balance sheet of engineers, right? And what is your cost of capital and your return on investment capital? And how are you thinking about, you know, the best way to manage this capital of your business, which is the code and the people who write it?
Yeah.
Interesting way of sort of reframing around this.
Yeah, I call it a post-spreadsheet era, right? When my wife's a bankruptcy attorney, I struggled in accounting with T-sheets. Kent and I did our MBA program. And we just, like, back then it was like balance sheets were different. Today, like you just said, it's people. The margins are high. It's like, what, you know, people go, how are oils moving? I'm like, I don't care. Like, I'm software all the time. I'm in a post-spreadsheet era. I'm in a post-Excel era. If we weren't in this era, stocks wouldn't trade at 50 times. Or I'm not saying it's good or bad or 50 times. So I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying I'm more comfortable in a post-spreadsheet era owning software companies at stupid valuations, post-textbook, post-Buffett, post-Munger, post-Graham, because I'm there building this with other people. We don't know what the metrics are in a post-spreadsheet world, right? Like, we don't know what things should trade at in a post-spreadsheet world because, like the Collisons told you, like, we live in this world where software is eating the world. And so I'm fascinated by that. So, like, oil's having a year, and I'm like, all right, let it have its year. I mean, people, there's ways to make money. I'll never understand oil. I'll never understand valuing it. I'll never understand wanting to own it. I'll never understand wanting to trade it. And so I'm fully implanted in a post-spreadsheet world. And what this recruiting thing has taught me is, man, I'd be a hell of a recruiter. I could just go as a second round and be a recruiter.
Well, it's really interesting that you described earlier, like, recruiting as these, like, I forget, did you call them pump and dump schemes?
Yeah,
or like, it's, these, like, it's like stock promotion.
There's no shame.
Right? You realize, like, oh, I see. The natural consequence of human capital, in quotes, is recruiting is stock promotion. It's bound to happen. Inevitable.
It's funny that you noticed that tweet out of all my lunatic tweets because you had a, I was only saying it because I wasn't thinking about it the way you're saying or the way Collison was thinking about a post-spreadsheet world. I was just saying my nephew, who's really smart, working in Indeed, is getting peppered with companies of which he can go to PitchBook or TechCrunch or wherever and look up the company, but he's calling his uncle who could call a VC or DM a VC and go, what do we know about this company? Like, the amount of, like, sidebar conversations between a 23-year-old who's worked 3 years at a software company and a venture capitalist who, like, the amount of, like, stuff in the system that you can go around all the old systems is phenomenal. And I don't even know how you measure it and where this all leads.
Okay, so this is really interesting that you brought this up because one place where this shows up very tangibly is if you are a free agent and you are looking at a bunch of different startups and you have to go decide which startup am I going to work for. There is a rule of thumb that seems just like unbelievably simplistic, but is generally pretty good, which is go with the ones that have the best investors, right? Find the startups that have really, really like grade A brand name VCs backing them up and go work there. So you might ask like, okay, like why is that not priced out immediately? Like, why is that good advice? Why actually is that a good signal for employees? And one really important reason why is because as an employee, you have almost no visibility into the company's cap table or like what kind of, you know, like what does their employee comp plan look like? How does this look compared to their future raises? Like, you don't have any visibility into this whatsoever. Even if you understand it, which most people don't, you have no visibility into it. Hmm. But if a company has really, really good VCs, right, who are doing it right and know what they're doing, the VCs will see to it that things are done right. Right? That's job number one for them, is making sure that employees are comped well and really, and comped professionally well, right? That things are not like done super loosely on the fly, but like, no, this will actually be a well-run program. And that is a fantastic way to compress very complex information into something really simple, which is it a brand name VC? Okay, great. I, a very sought-after engineer, feel super comfortable saying yes to this offer letter. That's a huge advantage over people who are not, right? It's one of the biggest advantages that VCs can impart their companies today, right? Is that brand halo that communicates this is done right, that creates that advantage where companies can go get the best people and then go climb their way into these massive valuations, right? That they, you know, recursively are able to self-generate.
Yeah, great point. What I used to say to my nephews, I'd say, well, in the old days we had IBM. In the new days we had Salesforce. And you can trust that and go work for a company whose product is rolling down the hill, whose product is flying off the shelf. Don't worry so much about comp, but find the products that are flying off the shelf. They'll have the best VCs. It's kind of like self-fulfilling in many ways because moss to a light. And if they have the best VCs, They'll have the best systems in place. They'll have the best software. And even if you're not making the most money and the most on your first stock, LinkedIn mm-hmm. will do its work. You'll get trained the best. You'll have the best headphones. You'll have the best pitches. They'll teach you how to first do pitches. They'll teach you how to close. They'll teach you how to all do these things. And it'll come into play in your second, third, and fourth job where you can take a little more risk, do your work. But now they can take smarter risks because it's not just about the VCs. It's about their network and how do they size up a company to make sure that they can maximize on their third job. What round do they go into a company where they can actually make some equity? So it's not just engineering, it's sales.
Right.
So, and again, that's enterprise. So it's not just what Collison says about the software capital unit of a person that can code. There is also something for the new IBM, you know, guy who used to wear a briefcase or the new Hoover salesman that went door to door. There is something to be said for someone who can follow a script and stick with the program and let the algorithms on LinkedIn do their work. And I just was fascinated to see the pitches that my nephew were getting, the shameless, we're on our way to multi-billion dollar exit, where if you said that on like a stock site, you're going to get kicked off of StockTwits,
right,
or you're going to not be taken seriously. It's fascinating.
That's such an interesting rabbit hole to go explore. Like, what are all the things that are like stock promotion, but where there are not rules of what you can and can't say? Oh, man, I feel like we could talk about this all day.
Okay, so now let's tap into e-commerce. And again, I'll edit this out. Just, Knut, just be ready if I edit it out because I didn't have a chance to ask you before. How do we feel about, like, I saw that I was down in Florida. I saw Open Stores, you know, Atomic and I think Rubois backed. You know, there was these Thrasios the last time we chatted, which are kind of like private equity meets e-commerce. And now I see that Open Store, which is, you know, backed by Rubois, who did Open Door, which is kind of like taking, you know, real estate down to the core. Is that good or bad for the ecosystem of e-commerce? Do you have an opinion?
I've got all kinds of opinions, but I think generally the goal, I'll tell you the goal. Let's start with the goal and then let's work backwards from the goal.
Okay.
The goal is for merchants to have power. We have this belief, which is that if merchants have power, that's good. What do I mean by power? Power can mean all kinds of things, right? Generally speaking, I'll tell you what power is not. Selling into Amazon, right, where you're just some anonymous seller of something on a third-party marketplace, that's not power, right? You have no power when you are selling through Amazon, right? It is, you don't own the sale, you don't own the storefront, you don't own anything, you are replaceable, mm-hmm. right? You just get surfaced by the Amazon algorithm and you might sell something into it and you can maybe make a business that way, but you don't have power. On the other hand, your business is yours, right? You can code it into whatever you want. You can go to whoever customers you want. You own that relationship. You can do anything you want. That business is yours. That's power. Generally, you know, like if merchants are in a position of strength where they can go build their business on their terms, they can go sell to who they want to, and they can actually use other powerful sources around them and trade with those sources of power on good terms or even on even terms, then that's great for commerce, right? One of the biggest sources of power in the universe is the capital markets, right? How could it not? It's the biggest reservoir of pure power in the world, right? Is the ability to go to other sources of capital and say like, hey, I can do something good with this money. At Shopify, you know, like this is something that we care about a lot. Even if you go beyond e-commerce, let's just think about all of startups for a second. How good is it that over the past 20 to 25 years, founders are able to tap these sources of power directly? Without having to go through seasoned CEOs, without having to go through all of these various gatekeepers to get them into the country club and things like that. You know, the closer you can get builders to power so that they can trade on even terms, the better results you're going to get for everyone.
And so at Shopify, this didn't happen right away. It happened on the Amazon store. Now it's happening on the Shopify store. Is that something that excites Shopify or you can't talk about it, or is it something that was inevitable? Or is this mall in the cloud just how the world is evolving?
I mean, I don't want to comment too specifically on any of the ways that people are doing this, other than generally speaking that like if merchants want to do it, then I'm in favor of it, right? As a general rule, that's a pretty good way to go. But I do think that if you know, the, like to just to extend this lesson of like what power means a little bit, it's really great when merchants feel that they have a really solid foundation on top of which they can go build what they actually want to go build, right? As opposed to feeling that they have to conform into some round hole, right? Or into some square hole, because that's the way that they are able to get through, you know, to some aggregator or some selling surface that they want to sell into, right? The more that it can be something that, you know, like they can feel that they built, the more all kinds of really nice self-fulfilling things happen around that, right? It's a little bit like homeownership, right? Like, what's the big deal about homeownership? Isn't this like, you might look at homeownership and say like, homeownership is an insane financial product, right? The idea that people can get these like fixed 30-year mortgages to go pay massive prices for houses through these really, really like strange government-backed models of like financing home buying when people could just rent the asset the way we rent every other asset. Why is it better? And the answer is, it's good to be a homeowner because it's yours, right? It's actually yours. You own it. You are responsible for it. You can turn it into something that it wasn't before. All kinds of businesses, whether you're talking about a Shopify store or a founder in a startup or anything, or honestly, a writer in a Substack for that matter.
So now that you've got a year and a half under your belt, what's the stuff that excites you? What's the stuff like Shopify Plus or Money, whatever I use when I'm on Instagram or whenever I'm using it, it's a magical experience for me. And I didn't even know that I needed it. That's how clueless I am about e-commerce. So as a 56-year-old man who does not go on Amazon because I'm scared I'll go broke, I wouldn't go broke in a casino. I could go broke on Amazon. What? A plane? How are you ordered a plane? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was a good deal. So in a world where that's happened, I have found myself clicking away using Shopify Money on Instagram around biking stuff and around golf stuff. Instagram, I've submitted myself to Instagram finally, not as someone who shares a lot of photos or reads through stories, but of like when I'm in the mood to please myself and see new, and I think it's doing a terrible job, by the way. I mean, it's doing a great job considering it's got me to pay Instagram, but doing a terrible job in really understanding what I like inside of cycling and really inside of golf. But yet here I am clicking away on Shopify Money. Does that even surprise you? Like the reason I'm finally on e-commerce is because of Shopify Money. It's not Square Cash. It's not Venmo. It's because of Instagram and Shopify Money.
So when you say Shopify Money, I'm going to assume you mean Shop Pay, which is sort of the buyer.
I mean the pay button.
Yeah, we're thrilled to hear that. Let me actually turn the mic around. Let me ask you some questions about why you feel that Instagram has not figured out exactly your cycling niche.
Yes.
I say this as a former amateur cyclist and still occasional amateur cyclist. So, okay. Is the issue you think that like you have all this gear, you don't really need more gear, but you always could purchase more gear. Are they not surfacing the right things to you? Are they not figuring out like how to get you motivated? What do you think is the issue?
The issue is, this is what I'm excited about. It's inspiring me to find a new rabbit hole to invest in, right? I had one trick, right? And my trick is I'm 56 years old and I've survived long enough to make money off my one trick, which is people are going to trade like your buy button. I knew that Robinhood, eToro, like StockTwits, Twitter, TweetDeck. When I started going down the YouTube rabbit hole with my content show in 2006 and I pivoted and sold it to CBS and then got caught up in the social web, I'm like, oh my God, Twitter's going to be Bloomberg. We're all going to be trading from TweetDeck. The dollar sign will lead to the trade. Twitter will be $1 trillion. You know, it was still open at the time. Yada, yada, yada. Here we are in 2021. There's Robinhood. There's Coinbase. Like everybody's screwed up. There's 100 more companies than there need to be. All the same companies that I thought were going to be in it are still in it. Goldman Sachs is doing as good as they ever have. Plaid, which is supposed to be, fintech, takes Goldman money and lets the whatever wolf coyote into the hen house. Like nothing's changed. So that's why I'm saying. And so here I am on Instagram in 2021 buying poorly packaged stuff because I can click a button and get this crap sent from China because it looks good on Instagram and there's no experience yet of what I want. I want to pay top dollar because I've earned that and I want to have the brands, I want to have Facebook understand that about me and just continually to evolve to get me to do the perfect purchases.
Let me ask you about the Twitter thing for a second because you touched on something that I've also been thinking about a lot as somebody who is on Twitter a lot. So Twitter clearly got something right for our peer set that nobody else has. and then managed to not execute on it for like 10 years until now they seem to be just starting to make headway into it, which is this idea of, are you going to let the people with audiences on Twitter start to make money off of that audience? Right, give them a grade. How do you think? What do you think happened? Why do you think they have earned the clown car in the gold mine reputation for as long as they have? And what do they need to do to get you buying things or consuming people's audiences, whatever it might be? What'll get you back there?
I still give them an F, and I say that with love. I feel that the company has no sense. Like I said, I've always said that Snoop Dogg would be a better CEO for this company than Jack, because this is the community. You go from Dick Costello to whatever the guy's name is now at SoFi. Maybe Adam Bain was the closest thing they could have had to like a gentleman community type CEO, to now Jack, who's like making jokes about Facebook. He hasn't been funny his whole life. Like, you're a great product guy. Stop using the product poorly. So if the CEO doesn't know how to use the product and the board doesn't know how to use the product, we're never going to get what we want out of Twitter, because there's no one representing you and I, Alex, for what Twitter is, which is a GLG, a marketplace of ideas, whether it's Jim O'Shaughnessy or Patrick or all the smart people that we interact with. We don't mind that there's slippage. We don't want to get paid. We would like the other people to get paid so they would contribute better content. So you and I aren't in it for the money. We never have been. We would have. I think Fred probably got it the most right, but they kicked him out of there at the beginning, was, hey, man, keep the protocol open.
That's right.
Would there be Bitcoin or Square? Would there be any of these companies, Venmo, if Twitter had just stayed open? Based on the initial like Bitly, TweetDeck, surmise, Twitter would be all of this. Twitter would be tipping from the beginning. Twitter would be the exchange, the trade, the fantasy bet. This would all be happening on Twitter. I don't think they can even start to get that back.
No.
But I hope, the reason I own the stock a little bit is because I hope that they can garner some of the transaction. I think selling newsletters is the weakest entry point of it, because they should be in a transaction that relates to financial or bets.
Well, let me ask you this, just to connect a couple dots from earlier in the show. We were talking before about recruitment, right? As an expression of, you know, when people are the capital and ideas are capital, then there are various new kinds of stock promotion, right? New kinds of pumps, new kinds of reflexivity, new kinds of, you know, of bubbles, right? Like all, like everything is a bubble now, like for better or for worse, everything's a bubble, right? Like it seems, and I guess like Twitter up until I would say relatively recently had, I don't want to say quite a monopoly on bubbles on the internet, because Reddit was also there. Mm-hmm. Reddit has also been like a place where this kind of thing has done well. But recently, it seems like there's starting to be this Cambrian of explosion of other places, like Discord, for example. Like if you're in the crypto community, you know, it's all like it used to be like back. It was, you know, Twitter and Telegram. Now it's Twitter and Discord. You have all of these places that are learning how to do the job of be the space where bubbles occur and where fabulously useful things are occurring as a result.
Yes.
Right. You know, the Carlotta Perez framework of bubbles is how we lay the infrastructure for future stuff. And a lot of times that infrastructure is just organization and ideas. You know, like if you look at DAOs, for instance, like we're learning how to like try this new kind of organizational behavior in Discord channels, right? Like because there is this temporary bubble that has taken place where in the middle of this bubble, we don't know what's good or not, but everything's going to get tried, right? That's the magic of these spaces.
Yeah.
Like, whether downstream from that is a stock number that goes up or down, or it is a kind of thing that gets built, or as a kind of community that gets created. There's so much good comes of this.
So much good comes of this. I just think you're helping me think through why I've been debating kicking Twitter out for the 100th time from my portfolio. It's like you have the screaming baby upstairs. You can't kick it out. It's your baby. So you're going to spend the time. You're going to sing to the baby. You're going to change their clothes. You're going to give them the FaceTime. You're going to do everything you can until that baby starts giving you the Heisman. Twitter gave its community the Heisman to chase the dollar. Okay. we can't get that back. When Dick Costello and them were making jokes about hiding the, you know, all the money they were raising at the beginning and all the drama in the boardroom, East versus West, you know, Fenton versus West Coast VC versus East, Union Square. I was there early. I play a great armchair quarterback on Twitter. I'm not so great at running businesses. You know, Twitter to me is the armchair quarterback center of the universe with both great quarterbacks and wannabe quarterbacks. And they have let the conversation, they spent so much time trying to keep Trump happy and trying to keep the fringes happy and trying to chase the almighty, you know, monthly recurring user, that in the end, you can't keep those people. The internet proves that. In an open internet, people will just leave and find another place. And we can't predict when it'll happen. I couldn't have told me that it would have been Discord as the place, because Discord wasn't built for crypto people. Like, the crypto people that are on Discord are not happy because they can't keep up with the conversation. So all this stuff stems from Twitter probably closing down, you know, by deciding which holes they were going to plug, as Fred Wilson would say. And you can't choose which holes you're going to plug at the danger of plugging the wrong holes, and you're going to be whack-a-moling the rest of your life. So I think you're starting to help me understand why it's like, I don't like Discord. I don't want to learn a new product. But at the same time, I'm not going to learn what I could learn about crypto on Twitter, because the smart people are in Telegram, Signal, WhatsApp, Discord, StockTwits, Twitter. They're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
There is no way. There is no town square anymore. There's no town square.
Okay, I have a thought here, and this is going to be a convoluted thought, but bear with me for a second. So, okay, you know Joe Weisenthal? Speaking of people on Twitter, who are great.
Yeah, very long time.
He, you know, always has interesting things to say. He's currently pissing off a lot of people with Mint the Coin right now. He's made that a flag that he's waving right now. God bless him. Anyway, he had a really smart comment 7-8 months ago, I want to say, that went something like this. It said, during the 2010s, when we had, you know, fresh off the financial crisis, nobody really knew what you had Sequoia's famous RIP Good Times memo that said, like, we don't really know how fundraising and startup building is going to look like if the world is financially in the toilet for a little while. But it turns out that if you were looking around, you know, for any time during the next 10 years, it was the biggest bull run in tech building that we're ever going to see. Right. It was just the stars aligned for it to be the greatest decade of just running through building all these amazing products. And at the time, there was this narrative around people mostly looking at it from the outside saying, the reason why we're building all these businesses is because there's too much money sloshing around. There's stimulus money. There's like too much money. It has to go find somewhere. So all this money goes and finds these weird, unprofitable companies that are losing money hand over fist as they grow. That must be why we can fund businesses like Uber. This is a pretty compelling narrative for people if you had kind of decided that you didn't like tech and you wanted to look for a reason why tech was succeeding. Oh, it must be because there's too much money and had to go somewhere. But in hindsight, the reality was the problem is not that there is too much money. The problem is that there was not enough money. We were so strapped for money, right? There was not enough capital around. We were so constrained all around the country that the only place where growth was happening was in the tech companies, right? If you wanted growth, the only place where you could go to buy it was paying up to get into the VC funds and paying up to get into Uber and Airbnb and Slack and all these companies. If you were some pension fund manager and you're looking at these low interest rates and these bleak, you know, versions of your future, unless you can find some way to get growth, you're going to pay anything to get into those companies. And that's exactly what happened. But then, you know, if you fast forward to today, you know, like up through and through the pandemic, and now we're having trillions of stimulus dollars going everywhere that's flooding into everywhere in the economy. Now people are realizing, like, oh, wait a minute. Maybe if all these other parts of the economy are growing too, tech doesn't have a monopoly on growth anymore, right? They're not the only game in town for being able to grow things, because now it's like if there's an extra couple $1 trillion sloshing around the country, you know, growth can be found all over the place. It can be in oil. It can be in anywhere, right? And so all of a sudden this, and it kind of explains why a lot of these Silicon Valley investors are really, really hawkish around things like inflation. Right. Which, again, like in this model actually makes total sense. Right. They're trying to defend their game. Right. They want to be the only game in town. It's great when there isn't very much money sloshing around the economy because they're the only ones. And so bringing it back to the point we were making before, it's like it seems like this kind of happened with Twitter and users. Right. When there are only a handful of these social platforms that were able to really get scale and have these users that were working and they were the only games in town. it was easy to say like, oh, the only reason why people are on Twitter and to a lesser extent Facebook, because I think Facebook is different behavior, but Twitter and Reddit and places like this is because, you know, like there's all of this sort of like pumped up reason for them to go there. And like, that's the only reason why they're there. But now it's like, oh, like tech has now progressed to the point where like these kind of bubbles, if we want to go use our earlier terminology, can exist everywhere. Bubbles are just absolutely everywhere. So now like Twitter no longer has a monopoly on them, right? You know, they lost their chance. I don't know. I'm pretty optimistic. I'm not a shareholder of Twitter, but like I am investing in the platform in the sense that that is where I spend my time, right? I'm not going to go learn some other thing, right? I'm not going to spend that much time on whether it was Clubhouse a few months ago or wherever it might be. No, Twitter is my home, right? Twitter and my newsletter are where I'm at, right? That's where I've planted my flag. I'm committed.
Myself as well. That was a good riff to pull it back together for me. I'm with you. I like to help people make money. I think in the world, like in these 8-to-80 type brands, and I'm constantly, again, it's not important. You know, people should be investing for the long term. People should be investing in private companies. People should be investing in themselves. They shouldn't be staring at the stock market. But I still, as someone who's been in the markets for so long, like to try and prune things down to 10 or 20 companies or sectors that people can sit back for 5 to 10 years and let the harvesting begin. Mm-hmm. And Twitter's one of those where it's underperformed, for which is why we talk about it so much. And I think your analysis is great. Like this supply demand boom bust, you know, Twitter doesn't have that control anymore. They waited mm-hmm. too long, and we're the last guys in the nightclub. It's not a bad nightclub. It's not the best nightclub. It's the nightclub that we need because our type of people hang out there, and we're rooting for it, kind of like our home baseball team or like our city, mm-hmm. but they just can't seem to get out of their own way or pick the right way, and we'll see. I think in a world where you just talked about where inflation and money is good, like we just never had enough money, and now there's enough money for climate change funds, mm-hmm. and now there's enough money for solar funds, and now there's enough money to send people to Mars, and now there's enough money to rethink, what do we call it, the supersonic jets coming back from mm-hmm. United of all companies.
I'm excited about that.
And now there's enough money to rebuild airports. Right, I'm too. And now there's enough money to do podcasting finally. So I think you're right. That's a great way to think about this. So I'm going to do one more hard change just because I was reading about your favorite idea in switching topics completely, because this is an investing show too. Why do you like this Twist Bioscience? I bought a few shares before the show just to keep an eye on it now. I didn't know if you were serious, or can you give me your take on why all of a sudden you like this company?
Oh, this is a fun topic. Okay, so following is an investment advice, et cetera. Twist is an awesome company. I first got to know Twist when I was at Social Capital, and all our bio-related portfolio companies were using them. And it was like, oh, that's very Stripe-like. Should keep tabs on these people. But so Twist, you know, so go read the thing I wrote for a primer on what Twist does and how they work. They are, you know, they make DNA as a service. They send it to you through an API. They're building the foundations of what could be an enormous infrastructure business for synthetic biology. Very cool business. The stock actually has an interesting lesson in it that's related to a bunch of stuff that we've talked about, which is, I forget. Okay. If you remember, tell me who said this, because I use this line all the time. It was someone on Twitter. I can't remember who said it, which says, don't confuse alpha with levered shit beta. Cause at the time it can be hard to tell them apart.
I don't know who said it, but that's a good one.
It's, you know, when things are ripping, it can be really hard to tell those two things apart until the tide goes out, right? And you see who's not wearing any pants. But I remember, like, I've been interested in Twist for, you know, some time now. And then over the past year, they had some ridiculous run up in their stock price when they were in ARK. They were a Kathy stock. You know, they had their moment as, like, I don't know if they qualified as a meme stock because people weren't talking about them specifically. But companies like that, right, were like, you know these, like, Twist sells at like, I don't know, 30x revenue or some stupid number like that. They're like, you know, burning cash like crazy. Like they're a startup, like they're a growth company. They're doing exactly what you want them to, but like, nonetheless, like this is that kind of company where, you know, stock went from 60 up to 200 and now it's back down to 100 or something like that. And it's like, well, like, now is where we find out whether this was alpha or whether this was levered shit beta. We're going to find out over the next couple years as to whether they are able to take the money that they raised at a fairly good valuation and actually put it to work or not. So, like, yeah, I remember, like, my neighbor Dave, who is a friend of the show, by the way, loves Talk Twist. Shout out to Dave. Saw that I was, you know, very into Twist, got in it with me. And he's, you know, he and I are opposites in the sense that, like, I make, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 trades a year. He makes 4 or 5 trades an hour. and now I now have him in the stock and now into a big hole because of me. So we get to now have some skin in the game as to whether this is actually alpha as opposed to leveraged shit beta. So we're going to find out.
I read it. I'll share it. I am intrigued because this goes to your bubble and money printing. And we need, you know, Stripe for biotech makes sense to me. Stripe for payments, whether it's for college and connecting all these things. So you're on the, you know, the bicycle of life, paying off things while you work, while you spend. Connecting all these things so that your money is working 24/7 should be the same about your health, should be the same about DNA, should be the same about biology. So that's very interesting. I'm excited to follow. I tend to think that what you've discovered is a really interesting company. Now the next move will show us a lot about what this company has. You know, that was the fun. The lesson I would say is not about alpha and leverage, it's about chasing, you know, stocks. Mm-hmm. The first time we've seen something that's not like a stock is in crypto, where, you know, things are public, and we'll talk about this the next time, but things are public before they even have a chance to be private. And stocks, though, that go public regular ways tend to have these moments where things come to a crescendo and now the crash happens. But the company hasn't changed. It's just investor behavior around the stock did its thing. So I think you found something interesting. I'm going to follow it and we'll check in on the next episode. Good. I know you got to hop. I appreciate your time. There's a million subjects that we didn't get to. And congrats on all the success with Shopify. And we'll have you back soon.
Thanks so much for having me. Enjoy the rest of your day, guys. Can't wait for part 3.
See you, man. So, KNUT, it was great to have Alex back on the show.
Always great to have Alex on.
The thing that I'm amazed at is at 32, he's positioned himself perfectly for the next 20 years to be at the center of a network, to be at the center of e-commerce, to be at the center of fintech. And, you know, doing it right now at home with the kids screaming upstairs, the world has changed tremendously. But, you know, people at that age can move around the world, have great careers, and position themselves at such a young age for the next 20 years. And today, here we are, where you have these people that are like large brands of one, where you can have conversations with them, where Alex can talk as well about fintech as he can about platforms in biotech. So anyways, that's what I love about the show. That's why I keep doing it.
He's a very impressive guy.
Impressive guy for his age. And it's fun to just break out any kind of topic. So you are listening to Panic with Friends. This is Knut and I talk to some of my favorite friends, investors, traders, venture capitalists, entrepreneurs. We're trying to live a little bit in the future, not 10 years in the future, sometimes just a week or a month, but just get that little edge, understand catalysts, understand how things work, understand how networks work, understand how companies work, and how to position ourselves and our kids and our friends and family on rocket ships and make a little money, invest for profit and joy. Thanks, Knut. You can find us on Spotify, Apple. We now have a YouTube channel. Just search my name, Howard Lindzen, on Apple or Spotify or YouTube. You can subscribe, and every week you will get a Panic with Friends episode. Have a great week, everybody.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or Stock Twits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.